Right. Mr. Henry, if you're ready, you may proceed.
I am, Your Honor. Thank you, and may it please the court, Chief Justice Livingston, Justice Gabriel, and Justice Pittman. My name is Byron Henry, and in this case, I represent the appellants. I've been the appellee at times in cases when the other side either waived or did not show up for argument, and I graciously gave the court back all of my time unless they had any questions. I'm a bit nervous about doing that as the appellant, so I'm going to address a couple of issues briefly, and if the court has no questions about those issues, I will give back the remainder of my time since there's no counsel on the other side, and I do believe that most of the issues are brief. But I do think there's a couple of important issues in this case, and one, the court can decide to take it up or decide the case on another grounds, which would avoid a little bit of the sticky nature of some of the procedural arguments. I like to think of it in the way as there's a way to write an opinion in this case that's a memorandum opinion, and then it's possible that there's a way, win or lose for me, that it's actually an opinion. And so let me address that briefly. It's basically two parts. One is procedural, and the other is more substantive, weighing of the evidence and looking at the record, which is quite lengthy in this case. This is a special appearance case. It's a basically a construction partners and managers deal where the construction partner and manager is suing a number of members of some LLCs, a number of LLCs, because he alleges that they owe him money and the entities owe him money. The real crux of the issue is whether or not the court has personal jurisdiction over these appellants based on the pleadings and the record. Procedurally, I think the issue comes down to, first, what is the live pleading the court should be considering in this case in order to measure the evidence and measure the way that, appellants responded to the evidence. It is the appellant's position that the proper pleading or the timely filed pleading is the pleading, the first amended petition filed by Mr. Pate. I'm going to refer to the appellees as Pate prior to the hearing, and that amended petition was met with a response, a verified special appearance by the appellants, and so the issue was joined after the first amended petition, and subsequent to that, a hearing was convened in the trial court that began in August of 2015. The anomaly of this is that the hearing was continued because the parties ran out of time to later on in November, and then subsequently, it started in October, of 2015, was continued to November, and at the November hearing on the day, the court decided to continue the hearing once again and allow the parties to do some depositions so as to streamline the hearing process. It was taking a little bit extra time. The judge and the parties thought it would be a good idea to depose these people, cull down the testimony for jurisdictional purposes, and present that to the court as opposed to putting it on the stand without discovery. During that time, Pate filed an amended pleading during the hearing, so to speak, because the hearing was continued, and amended his jurisdictional facts in the middle of a hearing. And that's the crux of the first dispute between Pate and the appellants is, what is the proper procedure if you are in the middle of a special appearance hearing, whether it takes 6 months because of continuances or whether it takes 4 days contiguously, to amend pleadings. And in this case, our position is that based on the case law, it seems that courts have been applying without holding as much kind of the rule 63, 66, and 67, that because the nature of special appearance hearings require pleadings and a framework which requires the defendants to meet those pleadings with a special appearance and then file all the evidence 7 days before the hearing, it's appropriate to treat the special appearance hearing as sort of a mini trial on that issue for purposes of pleading amendments. Otherwise, you get into a quagmire of how to, once the amended pleading comes in and you're in the middle of a hearing, is an amended special appearance required during the hearing? And obviously, you can't do affidavits 7 days before the hearing if you're in the middle of a hearing. So courts have applied sort of the trial amendment 7 days before trial under Rule 63, or the trial amendment rules under 66 and 67 to sort of lend some structure to the whole process. And in this case, the appellees of Pate filed their amended petition during the hearing. And our position is that when you file an amended pleading during the hearing, it's like filing an amended pleading during the trial. There are some pleadings that are cleanup pleadings. They drop claims. They fix some things that don't substantively alter the case. And usually those are easily granted, and the trial court has broad discretion. But in this case, the appellees went from no allegations of personal jurisdiction in their first amended petition, which means that all the defendants my clients had to do was meet that petition with, we're not residents of Texas, under the case law. That was met. Then in the middle of the hearing, it was new jurisdictional allegations were made that, of course, we couldn't meet with a special appearance because we were in the middle of the hearing. And, of course, we couldn't file affidavits because we couldn't file them 7 days before the hearing.
Did you ask for a continuance?
No, we didn't, Your Honor. And our position is basically that the because, and I think we cited a Dallas case, the Smith Detective Agency case, and a few other cases that lay out the process by which we would have objected to their pleading by the way they would file a motion for leave, asking the court to allow them to amend their pleadings, at which the issue would be joined as to whether or not it's substantive or just procedural. And if it's just a procedural amendment where they're dropping claims, we would have just agreed or the court would have granted it. But we didn't really have the opportunity to object to their motion for leave because they didn't file a motion for leave. They just filed a pleading, which basically changed the entire nature of their allegations as to why the court had jurisdiction over our client. So we did not move for a continuance. We took no action at that time. We finished discovery, and then at the final day of the hearing, when all the evidence was presented, we made the argument that the court shouldn't consider the second amended because it was filed during the hearing, and opposing counsel took it as an objection, and he actually cited in his argument to the court that our objection is untimely, that we should have objected prior. Our position was a motion for leave was required to the extent you can amend in the middle of a hearing and completely alter the basis for personal jurisdiction at all, if that's even proper, then we believe a motion for leave was required. So we don't believe we waived our objection, and that's the first crux is, did they need to file a motion for leave and how that played out? And obviously, if the court finds that we had to do something affirmatively to stop them from changing the nature of the case in the middle of the hearing without them asking for leave, then we waived our objection. Otherwise, we believe a motion for leave was required. We would have responded with an objection and asking the court not to grant leave. So the question is, was the second amended properly before the court in the procedural posture in which it was filed? Bless you.
And the third continued hearing was on what date?
I believe that was November. I'm going to have to.
We have November 2015.
November 23rd, 2015, Your Honor. That was the date on which the, It's August 12th, 2016 was the final day of the hearing. Just for the timeline, the special appearance hearing began on October 13th, 2015, was continued to November 23rd, at which the parties agreed to break, do some discovery, and come back. Came back in August of 2016 and completed the hearing, presented the remainder of the evidence, made the arguments, and then the trial court ruled shortly thereafter after taking it under advisement. We did both object to the court considering the second amended, as well as object to the fact that even, and this is really the second part of the argument, is even if you consider the second amended, which is sort of getting away from the whole procedural thicket of when people file things, whether motion for leave is required, and the interplay between the trial amendment rules, is simply based on the allegations that were made in the pleadings. The record and the evidence conclusively establishes that the court does not, that those events did not occur. The sole allegation, even in the amended pleading, that they allege that they have jurisdiction over the appellants, is that some meetings occurred prior to the formation of each one of the entities in the case, at which, if you liberally construe them, the court could probably glean from it that either some agreements were made, some misrepresentations were made at those meetings, or both, from which these claims arose. So that's the gist of their claim. The problem is the record affirmatively establishes that no meetings took place before the entities were formed at which any of these things occurred. So it's sort of like someone alleging I have jurisdiction over you because you own property in the state of Texas, and we go to a hearing, and the record affirmatively reflects I do not own any property in the state of Texas. The case should be over. Now, what the – sorry, Justice Pittman.
I was just going to say, so ultimately, either way, whether this court considers the live pleading to be the original petition or the amended petition, the evidence that came out at the special appearances hearing negates all the allegations, even in the amended petition. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the reason I think it is an issue is because the appellee's counsel, made the argument to Judge the trial court below that because 120A is stated broadly that the court should consider all the pleadings, all the evidence in the record, convinced the trial court that even if the evidence that comes out during the hearing has contacts and other bases for jurisdiction that are not in the pleadings, she can consider those. I strenuously argued to the trial court that regardless of what comes out during the special appearance hearing, the only stick by which personal jurisdiction can be measured is the actual pleadings of the allegations in the pleadings. This court's decision in KKT says so. Kelly, the case cited throughout our brief, says so, that you start with the pleadings. We're only required to even rebut what's in their pleadings. We don't even have to rebut other contacts. But if you look in their brief, you'll see a summary of each contact for each individual. And they all start with the same contact where business was talked about, and that's in November of 2007 at a meeting after one of the party's son's wedding. And that meeting occurred after all of the entities had been formed. And so there are, now they do list a number of contacts after that meeting, and they go on to list 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012. But even giving their second amended pleading the most liberal reading in the English language, there is no doubt that their whole case revolves around meetings that occurred prior to the formation of the entities. And because the date of the entities is set in the evidence as a matter of the defendant's exhibits in the fifth volume of the reporter's record, 1 through 8, established the date each entity was formed. And they all were formed in 2007.
Why would it not be enough if they're at a wedding or a social event talking about forming the entities? Why wouldn't, and they're in Texas, why would that not be enough of an appearance?
Two reasons, Justice Bennett. One, that's not what they alleged in their pleading, so I think it's outside the bounds of what the court's allowed to consider. But secondly, it would be enough if they met in Texas and talked about business. I believe that the contacts that occurred that aren't pled for in jurisdictional basis, I'll be frank with the court, there are some of those allegations that tie to some of the claims, so specific jurisdiction would probably attach to some of the post-2007-2008 contacts had the plaintiffs relied on those contacts. And of course, we would have, of course, conducted discovery and we would have addressed some of the connection between the claims. In other words, the first claim is the contact in specific jurisdiction. The second test is whether or not the actual claims arise from the contacts. So we didn't really get into at the special appearance hearing or in our briefing to the court about the arising between the post 2007 contacts or whether or not those contacts gave rise to the actual claims in the case, because they were not relying on any post-2007 contacts in their pleadings. So the real question for this court to decide, first of all, is which pleading are you measuring? If it's the first amended, it's pretty much case over because no one disputes that my clients don't reside in Texas, and they filed a special appearance verifying that fact in response to a pleading that had no jurisdictional allegations. If you consider the second amended, the reason there's a difference, even though I still believe we prevail based on the specific language in their pleadings and the bases they pled, is that you need to look at the record. You have to read the deposition testimony. You have to check the citations by my side and their side, and I actually agree with the contacts that are listed in the appellee's brief at pages 17 to around 23 for each one of the defendants, or each one of my clients. Each one of them have contacts listed. The problem is that all of the contacts they have in their brief and they talk to the trial court about all occurred after 2007. And one last thing about amending pleadings. Kelly, specifically in a footnote, says, if evidence comes out that does not conform to what you allege in your pleadings, you need to amend your pleadings to conform to the evidence for consistency. Doesn't say how to do that. So I'm not sure this court needs to get into that process, but it's no doubt that things came out at the hearing. There were additional contacts at the hearing and in the evidence that were not relied on in the plaintiff's pleading, and they never amended their pleadings to include any of those contacts or alleged that they were relying on any of those contacts. So all this court has is one allegation of jurisdiction based on meetings that occurred prior to 2007, which the record affirmatively establishes did not occur and no claims could have arisen from those meetings. So whether you consider the first or the second, I believe the trial court's judgment on this case should be reversed. But one way it's determining the procedural issues of which pleading is proper. The other issue is just looking at the record to determine whether or not, I don't believe we disagree on the contacts themselves, just they're not, a lot of the contacts in their brief and in the record are not relied by the plaintiffs in their pleading to establish jurisdiction, so I think the court is foreclosed at looking at those.
Did you object to any of the meetings or events that took place in Texas in 2005 or 2006?
What do you mean, object to them?
Well, I mean, I think your allegation is that the corporations were all formed before 2007, where you for sure had some meetings. But weren't there a few that took place prior to 2007?
Yes, there was a meeting that took place in 2005. It's a meeting about the premium project. It's dealt with in our brief, Chief Justice. And it basically, the evidence conclusively establishes that the plaintiff is not suing us for anything that occurred at that meeting. The evidence reflects nothing occurred at that meeting, that no agreements or representations. And in fact, there's even testimony, and it's undisputed, that not all of my clients were even at that meeting. So if the court were to parse somehow the 2005 meeting and give the plaintiff the benefit of the doubt, I don't even think they argue in their brief when they start with the contacts. He starts with 2007 and goes forward. They're not arguing the 2005 meeting plays a role in their claims.
All right, thank you, Mr. Henry. We appreciate your arguments today and your briefing on this matter. Your case is submitted and you are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Be careful going home.